everybody doing? David Griscom here with this week's Griscom Stream. Hope you are well wherever you are at. I'm really excited today. We have two great guests to come on, and they're going to be talking to us about Cuba and the recent delegation of labor and those in solidarity with the Cuban people. It'll be much needed because we're also going to open up today by talking about some bad news here in the state of Texas. As people know, these shows are a little bit more casual and laid back and fun, so we always love to have your participation. So feel free to jump in the chat with any questions, comments, or ideas that you have. But before we get to Cuba, and I'm going to try to keep my spirits high because this is really difficult and frustrating news that we got today. It was something that we knew was probably coming. There were hopes that maybe it could have been stopped, and obviously there is the long fight ahead to push back against this. But this afternoon, my governor, Greg Abbott, signed HB 2127, a law that was introduced by Representative Dustin Burroughs of Lubbock into law in Texas. And what is this? This is a preemption bill. So what does that mean? It's a bill that basically will block localities, cities, and local governments from being able to put forward regulations on a whole host of subjects, from things like agriculture, housing, healthcare, and I think most damningly, labor law. As people know from our coverage in Texas, this is a state that has been dominated by the Republicans for a long time. But in the major cities where the vast majority of people live here, you do have more Democratic control, Democratic Party control, and you also have really great progressive and Democratic socialist representatives, for example, like in the city of San Antonio. And as we fight against the GOP on the state level, there's been a lot of pushes to change the labor laws in the state of Texas because the laws that are on the books are not written in workers' favor, and they have extremely dangerous consequences. What this is going to mean is that workers here who have been able to win things like paid sick leave, also fights for water breaks, they are very likely to be rolled back by the state. And I'm going to play this very quick video explaining this and then talk a little bit about the context before we get into Cuba. This is from local news in San Antonio.
Even just a few minutes outside in this heat can have you reaching for a cold drink of water. The city of San Antonio is looking at requiring companies give construction workers time for water breaks.
My colleagues of former Councilmember Ana Sandoval drafted a council consideration request to explore a potential ordinance to ensure that San Antonio construction workers have an opportunity to stop and have a drink of water so that way they don't face death.
Councilwoman Castillo says Texas leads the country with the highest number of heat-related deaths. But a bill waiting for Governor Greg Abbott's signature will restrict cities from creating local rules that state law already covers. It's called a preemption bill.
Whether you're talking about rest breaks or water breaks for construction workers, whether you're talking about payday lending ordinances and some other things that cities and counties have taken it on themselves to regulate across Texas.
Braddock says the bill is vague and exactly how the legislation would affect local policy is unclear.
The San Antonio city attorney has noted that there are so many questions and policies that would be in lieu, meaning that we have so many ordinances that we have already passed. So what does that mean for those?
It's going to frustrate average people, the folks who are watching KSAT, when they can't go talk to their city councilman or woman, their mayor, their county commissioner, to get something addressed because that power was taken away from them by the state of Texas.
In the coming weeks, the city council will meet to discuss the water break ordinance and hope to get a better idea of how the preemption bill will impact local rules.
First of all, note Terry Castillo there is a DSA member in San Antonio. but look, the argument that the Republicans are making is, silly. What they're saying is that the laws and regulations are too difficult in the state of Texas for businesses, particularly small businesses, to get by. That's complete bullshit. What this is an attempt and a deliverance on the demands of organized capital in the state to continue to brutalize workers. If people remember, we had Gus Bova on the program recently to talk about just one of these deaths, Antelmo Ramirez, who died while building the Tesla Gigafactory just down the road from me. This is a company, Tesla, that came to the state of Texas because they wanted to take advantage of weak labor laws and are going to continue to benefit from that because of the gift that people like Greg Abbott and the entire Texas GOP regularly give them. The people who pay the consequences are people like us, workers. As folks know who watch the show, I used to work in concrete. I know what it's like to work in the summer, and I know what it's like to work without having those kind of protections, having to fight with my coworkers to demand that the bosses allow us to drink water when it's 100 degrees outside. This is a life and death issue. This is something that goes beyond any kind of argument about regulation, or it's too tricky for businesses to get by. This is a very clear attempt by the government and by capital in this state to be able to excuse the inexcusable, and that is the high amount of worker deaths that are completely avoidable. This will affect a whole host of other issues. I think it's important not to accept their framing and to fight back the same way that the GOP fights against workers, to push to the very extent of the law to say that we have these rights, we're going to demand them, and we're going to fight for them if need be. But it's an extremely, extremely dark day in the state. We talk a lot about the weakness of the Democratic Party here that allows this kind of shit to continue. But frankly, when it comes down to it, it's absurd that in the United States of America, we have no protections for workers in heat. There is not a federal standard right now for workers when it comes to working outside in the heat, which is something that has always been extremely dangerous, but it becomes even more so, it becomes even more dangerous as the temperatures continue to climb all across the country. So in the short term, people here, we got to continue to fight back, get organized, get serious, because our rights are under assault. Even things that we thought maybe had been settled or moving in the right direction can be taken away like that. And on the federal level, we need to be pushing for just basic common sense workers' protections that we haven't got from the Biden administration. So we'll have much more on that. If people haven't listened to our interview with Gus Bova on some of the abuses at the Tesla facilities here, you should definitely check that out. Also read Gus Bova's piece in the Texas Observer. And, you know, keep tuned into Left Reckoning, because there's a lot of really dangerous and important fights that are happening in the state. And, you know, it's hard for me sometimes because it's so real and you feel it. We're talking about your neighbors, your friends, your family who are under assault from these kind of things. But it's also important to remember that there have been times in this country's history that were even bleaker than today. And people realize that when we fight together, when we organize, we can win, and to never lose sight of that kind of hope. But anyways, folks, we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about something hopefully a little bit more positive. We have on the program today Professor Charles Simmons and our good friend and returning guest, Amina Sheikh. Thank you all so much for joining us today on Left Reckoning.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Dave.
Yeah, I'm really happy to have you all on, and, you know, I'm really happy that I'm going to set this up. I know that there's so much to get into, but maybe just to sort of set the stage before we talk more broadly, maybe about Cuba. Could y'all tell us about this delegation that y'all are on in Cuba?
Yeah, why don't I let Professor Charles go first?
Well, my delegation was the National Network on Cuba. It's a umbrella organization of many groups that go to Cuba. Pastors for Peace is one of the groups that I'm familiar with, and also the Vince Ramos Brigade, which has been going for about 50 years, I think.
Wow.
Of course, I had been to Cuba in 1964 in the early days of the revolution, that when I was a student at Wayne University in Detroit. And I went, in order to get there, it was a secret trip, sort of. We were trying to keep the government from going, from knowing how we were going. We went from Detroit to Chicago to Philadelphia to Paris to Czechoslovakia to Ireland to Newfoundland to Havana, just to get 90 miles from the United States. And we challenged the State Department travel ban. Mm-hmm. And that's, they took our passports and also brought us before the, my group from Detroit were brought before the federal grand jury saying that we were going to blow up the Statue of Liberty and Washington Monument. So that was my first experience. But during that time, I got to meet Che Guevara and Fidel. So that was the height of the enthusiasm.
I mean, could you talk about that a little bit? How was that meeting? You can't just drop that and not give us a little more.
I met Fidel at a university. I was in the at the University of Santiago, I believe. I was talking to some students, and all of a sudden, everybody jumped up and started running outside, and I didn't know what was happening. And they start shouting, "Fidel, Fidel!" And we went outside, and there he was in a car with three other men, all in their fatigues. And the students actually physically pulled him out of the car, and he stands up over the car, and they start debating what was happening in the country. It's arguing back and forth over the car. And I was trying to imagine that happening to with John F. Kennedy in the United States with no bodyguards. Well, maybe they had two bodyguards, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. One was a doctor. And the next time I saw him, well, we had a baseball game. He played the Cubans played the United States delegation. And, of course, they beat the hell out of us. Because they're serious about baseball. The second time was at the 26th of July celebration, which is very much like the State of the Union's message, except that there's a crowd of a zillion people outside listening to the speech. And the speech may last for 4 hours or more. But he is examining and commenting on each region of the country, the strengths and weaknesses of their economic development plan. And in the midst of his speech, a farmer interrupts the president, and Fidel stops and has a one-on-one conversation with the farmer about whether the cows that they had imported from Ireland or somewhere were meeting the standards that they needed in his community. Mm-hmm. And after they resolve that, Fidel goes back to his speech, and then somebody else will interrupt him, and he has a one-on-one with that person. And so it was just mind-blowing to see this type of a true democratic relationship between the leadership and the ordinary people. Mm-hmm. Fidel may come out. He they would have a street party somewhere. He comes out. He's dancing with the people. So that's another level of leadership that I had never imagined. Meeting with Che was a gathering of the African-American delegation, about 10 of us met him. And we talked about the education programs, for example, which led to the development of the Cubans offering scholarships in the United States for people of color to go to school, go to med school free, which they do now. Mm-hmm. But it was a major introduction to what democracy could become that we have never experienced here.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely want to get into that a little bit more. But I mean, Amina, if you could talk a little bit about your experience recently to everyone.
Yeah, well, thanks again for having me back. And yeah, my experience, I really wanted to share it because I've been to Cuba before, but like individually as a tourist. And I wanted to emphasize that I went as a tourist. You know, a lot of Canadians are able to travel to Cuba, and Cuba and Canada have a very different relationship. That's not to say that the embargo and blockade, like it still has an obvious impact, but Canada, Cuba have maintained that friendship since the 1900s, really. And this experience was with the Che Brigade, and the Che Brigade was actually in its 29th year. And I purposefully picked a brigade because I wanted to do a trip that's not like an individual, but with a group and an organization that does credible work. And actually this year I was elected to the Canada-Cuba Friendship Association. So I'm on the executive, and they were very kind enough to give me a scholarship. They also gave five other scholarships to Indigenous identified people who wanted to go. And so our trip was really amazing. We had 30 brigadistas, I'm trying to say that word, on this trip. And I was still pretty skeptical. I don't know what the word is. I've never been on a brigade, so it was very new to me. And really, it was life-changing, and it really, not only just traveling with a group of organizers, trade unionists, activists, but also like arriving in Cuba, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit, but like going with a brigade really pushed me to, you know, like negotiate and cooperate and like learn about other people who in the country that I live in, you know, Canada, like share the same views as me and like connect with them. There were people from the prairies. Was there somebody from Alberta? I don't remember, but like there was a big group from BC, and really, we really bonded. I happened to by chance come really late, and they didn't forget about me, but they got me a private driver, and he picked me up from Veradero and drove me to Havana really late at night. And when I arrived, actually, Chris Smalls and the Amazon labor union folks were outside. They were like, "What happened to you?" And it was just like, it started great from that moment, you know, and all the brigadistas were kind of from around the world were in Havana. And like, it was such a great week for me. And I know 2 weeks for some people. And yeah, and I'll get more into some of the highlights and why I think other trade unionists should be going, and why our unions should be funding like professional development and supporting this sort of worker to worker, people to people connections, and why it's really important for us to see. And the way we can really learn about the truth is by going there.
I mean, I'll just say, like, I haven't been to Cuba, but I had a really incredible experience one time when I was in Spain. You know, I just walked into a bar, and there's this incredible Cuban jazz band playing, and I, you know, sat in the front row, was having a great time. And then after the show, you know, I was sitting outside, and the band came out, and I started talking with them, and then we went back inside and had some drinks. And it was just, as an American, it was just like a really incredible experience, one of like camaraderie and like, you know, friendship in that experience. But also, you know, there was something really tragic about it that, you know, I had to go across the ocean to another continent to meet, you know, effectively my neighbors, and be able to have like that kind of one-to-one conversation with them. Because, you know, Americans like get have a lot of perceptions around Cuba, but it's very rare that it's coming from like Cubans who are still living and participating in life in Cuba, right? And people are very blocked off from what life is like there. So I'm curious if either of y'all had any thing that you wanted to share to, you know, to any, you know, they could be Canadians or Americans, it doesn't matter, but like anyone who like might not understand, like, for example, like, you know, when you land in Havana, I mean, like, what is that experience like? You know, I mean, there's like the imagining is it's drab and miserable, and you know, it's a horrible experience, but I think that's very far from me.
Very far from that. Like, I like felt very safe, and I felt safe in 2017 too. And I really want to emphasize that, because I know we're all like obsessed with safety, but it's like funny. I don't really feel safe in Toronto. And the trip was really emotional for me, because I was born and raised in Toronto as an immigrant. And, you know, like as a Muslim, yeah, I haven't felt safe a lot of times, you know, and just walking down the streets and post pandemic. And it's not, it's again, these are structural problems, you know. The biggest thing I think our brigadistas and all the, I think there were about 800 to 1,000 people. I mean, there were brigades from the UK. There was a brigade from Korea, so, you know, you had all these different brigades. And I think the biggest thing we all said was, have you noticed how lonely like our lives are? Like, you come back and it's so lonely. And like, the one thing I saw in Cuban society is like the affection, the love, the softness that people have for each other. And it's very different from Canada, you know. People are say loving words and speak to you with like words of adoration, and they compliment you, and they really are a loving society. And the other thing is, it's just like a collective society where everybody relies on each other and everybody does everything together. And also, again, being on a brigade, you know, pushes everybody to like get up together and, you know, coordinate together, because I want to mention that going there is difficult because of the embargo. Mm-hmm. And Professor Simmons can talk about that too. It's like, you know, all the logistics and all like fuel, food, mm-hmm. right? And Professor Simmons can talk about that too. It's just like people are really struggling with the food scarcity and shortages. And I mean, the lineups were always there. This is because of the US embargo and how it impacts ordinary people. And but the other major thing I was going to say, and I wanted to connect it to Texas, is my brigade and many of the brigades visited different unions. So I got to visit the artist union, and I learned, you know, that like artists, like, you know, got a wage that was sustainable so that they can be artists, and that like Cuba, since Fidel, since the revolution, like really supports education. They've had many what they call education revolutions, but also art, and how art is part of the resistance, but it's also accessible to everyone. And really, their labor laws, comparative to Canada and the US, mm-hmm. surpass us. And this is something that you, as trade unionists, we have to go witness. And there are tons of articles on there on the internet, you can read them, that have been published from the UK and from other places about the democracy of the trade unions and how workers vote on, you know, regionally and at different levels to have representation. And the other profound aspect of the unions is that they have industry-wide bargaining unions. And this is something that like Canadians like look to Scandinavia as a model, right? Like we're looking to Europe as we need to go back to sectoral bargaining. And for all those watching, sectoral bargaining means like the entire sector is in one union so that you have power, right? Mm-hmm. But now if we look in the West or North America, like the NLRB, OLRB have been gutted, right? Mm-hmm. Labor relations boards have been gutted by governments. And then on top of that, you have negotiation and bargaining between like if you look at one sector, let's say like universities, right? You have 100 different unions. You have unions for the food workers, custodial, for all these different people. And then the bargaining isn't strong. Where in Cuba, like, they're all together. So for example, teachers are in a union with kitchen staff, teachers are in a union with custodial. And I think we have a lot to learn from just going there, and we can see like the worker power. We can also see how like workers do, you know, this is a project where workers run the country.
So unless you had something that you wanted to add to that, Charles.
I had when I went to Cuba, I had at the first time in 64, I was also working in a factory in the auto industry here in Detroit. And the labor was very intense. This is before the deindustrialization. We were still a major auto producer. And the work was so difficult in Detroit. The pay was high, but the work was a man killer. And it was... we couldn't stop. You could barely get a break to go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And if you ate lunch, you had to sit down where you were and eat. And that you got about 15 minutes for that to go back to work. You would be so exhausted at the end of the day, all you could do is go home and just collapse and get back up the next day and go back. In Cuba, we went to visit some factories, and the factory workers would stop working and come over and talk to us. Now, that by itself was shocking to me, that was unheard of in Detroit.
Yeah.
And they had education going on in the factories because they were dealing with illiteracy. They had a major illiteracy campaign. because Cuba had a high literacy rate, and as did most of the countries in the global South, and shifting to the education issue. They had a campaign in which they sent volunteers from high school and college and other citizens, went to the most remote parts of the country where the literacy rate was extremely high. And they lived on the farms or up in the mountains with a family and worked during the day. And then at night taught the family how to read and write.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to eliminate probably over 95% of illiteracy in about 3 years. And they have the highest rate of literacy in any of the developing countries, and probably as high as we have in Detroit. That was the beginning of it. And they brought students from the poor areas of the country and gave them scholarships, and they lived in the palaces where the rich people were living in Havana. Went to school free as a result of this literacy project. So this time, when I was looking at the students going to school in Havana, I saw the young people from the countryside, all the different ethnic racial groups were going to school, and they looked very healthy and robust.
Mm-hmm.
They commented. They said that the Cuban students go to school with backpacks and books, and the American students need to be going to school with bulletproof vests. Well, that's true, although we don't. And in fact, with all the mass shootings in the United States, everybody here needs to have a bulletproof vest or two. So I was impressed with the education developments. And education, of course, is free through the university level.
Mm-hmm.
I was impressed with their medical system. First of all, healthcare is free.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 82 years old. So the second day I was there this time, I told her I was not feeling well, and I'm going to stay. I'm not going out on the tour today. And the next thing I knew, there was a doctor, a nurse, a paramedic, and an ambulance at my door. And they did testing on me in the hotel room. Then they took me to the hospital. They said that a lot of elders who travel from the U.S. get pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they were also concerned about COVID,
mm-hmm.
but I had never had that much medical attention in my life mm-hmm. in the United States.
And no anxiety that getting some attention was going to mean you get a scary bill.
Right. I didn't pay anything, and they don't pay anything. And they have a system where the healthcare is begins in the neighborhood. So, they have clinics in the neighborhood where the doctors and nurses actually live in the same community that they serve.
Mm-hmm.
They know everybody in their region, and they have their medical records. They go from door to door with an emphasis on preventative healthcare. But it is a profound example of what can be done. And this Cuba is a poor country.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cuba is a threat to the United States in terms of a role model to show the world what a little country can do if they have the will to do it. And they can provide the essentials for everybody in the society because they have the desire and the will. We could do the same thing here, and other countries can do the same thing, but you won't have zillionaires and trillionaires and stuff taking all of our resources. So that's the threat of Cuba. Cuba is not a threat militarily, mm-hmm. politically, so any other way. It's just that it represents a threat to our economic system that intends to maintain poverty and oppression and homelessness, shutting down schools and shutting down libraries. Other mm-hmm. people around the world are trying to build schools and open libraries. We're trying to close them. So that is the threat that Cuba represents.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing we talk about on this program is kind of weird tech fetishism that you get in America, right? Where it's like, oh, this new technology is going to fix healthcare. And it's like, look, I'm all for using new technologies and things like that. But like, we already have the social technology it exists, right, to take care of people, right? The problem is the political and the economic yes. system, not that we don't have AI doctors or something like that. But I'd be curious to, because I definitely want to talk a little bit more about like their actual system, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about that. But I think like to paint this full picture, you know, I think one thing that's really notable about Cuba is, as you're saying, is like, you know, it is a poor country, like, you know, if you're judging by like GDP or something like that. And yet it's able to provide, you know, significant amounts of goods and services to its people. But it's been hit really hard. It continues to get hit really hard by the embargo. You know, and I just know, like, I know personally people who are from Cuba who had to leave because they were struggling under the embargo so much. I'm curious if y'all could, you know, talk a little bit about like that consequence of U.S. policy on Cuba.
Well, you want to go first, Amina? Okay. There are tremendous shortages. Even while just before we landed, there was a fuel crisis, and they had to reschedule everything because the buses were not able to travel the routes that they had planned. Hmm. There's shortages of food. There's shortage of supplies in every way. The blockade prevented people from even getting oxygen and COVID medical equipment and supplies during the COVID. And this was intentional to try to strangle the people in Cuba and make them change, make them accept being under the U.S. domination. But they share their resources. And it reminded me, I spent time on a farm in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And the poor people in the country, they shared everything. Mm-hmm. If somebody needed a house built, we all went and built the house. Whatever we needed, people would come and help us. So what they're calling socialism, I've experienced that living in the southern United States in the 1940s. But people can share, but we have such an intense individualistic value system in the United States that it makes it difficult for people to work together. Mm-hmm. And they deal with that problem very successfully in Cuba. Now, it's true, many people have left, and probably if this continues, many more people will have to leave. And the United States authorities are complaining about the immigration crisis on the borders. Mm-hmm. Well, the immigration crisis exists because of the devastation that the U.S. implements upon the peoples of the global South. And so mm-hmm. they have to leave because we are destroying their economies or implementing warfare that people are leaving because of the political crisis. So we are causing the immigration problem, and then we're complaining about it. We can't have it both ways.
I think that's fair. Most of our audience are smart people, so they wouldn't have this kind of objection. But like, if you need to consider like what is happening in Cuba, think about what happened in this country, for example, during the COVID crisis, right? Where like, you know, little shortages can create like big problems in the like economy, right? And like, if you're one of these people who's like, America's so great, well, look what happened here where we had like a slight hiccup in, you know, things that we were able to import into this country, and think about how much serious supply chain damage and things like that. And then imagine having that for, you know, upwards of 60 years on your country. I mean, you know, it's truly a testament to the Cuban system, how well they are doing despite, you know, this continued embargo on the country.
I don't think the United States could stand a blockade for 1 month. And they are still, it's a miracle that Cuba is still in existence as a socialist project, with all that we have done to the Cubans to destroy that economy, to destroy the leadership, and to make them go backwards into accepting a colonial status. Mm-hmm. But they refused to do that. And so we punished them and have decided we want to destroy them for standing up. And it's contagious. The standing up is contagious. It's going on all over the American hemisphere. And we'll continue to expand. So we have to get, we're on the wrong side of history. We're always talking about celebrating the American Revolution. And at one time we may have been on the right side of history, but we are no longer on the people side of history. So we have to change that. We have to eliminate this blockade of other parts of humanity. With the sanctions, the blockade, we're intentionally creating poverty, disease, and all types of social illnesses that are not necessary.
It's true. I mean, it's human made, right? I'd just be curious to hear y'all's, you know, perspective speaking with Cubans, right? Because, like, as you were just saying, right, like there's a lot of reason for them to be very mad at us, right? And rightfully so. But like when y'all are able to talk to them, I mean, what I'm gathering is like there was like an appreciation of the solidarity of these brigades, right? That there were, you know, people coming from these places saying that we want to, you know, change the U.S. Or I'm curious, you know, if y'all had any conversations with folks on that level.
I can contribute there. I am an organizer full time in Canada, so I'm just used to talking to random people all the time. And I don't, you know, like Google Maps and all that. By the way, there's not very good Wi-Fi structure, and that's because of the blockade. But so you really have to ask for support a lot there. And I think Charles would agree, like you have, like even in the hotel, you have to talk to people. There's so many logistic, like infrastructural issues, right? Like rooms, like buildings, you know, roads, all these issues are there that impact ordinary Cuban people. But what's so amazing about them is that I learned within that week, and even before when I came in 2017, they always help you. Mm-hmm. And we were going to talk about the impact of the blockade. I really want to be honest. People are really thin, like, you know, and I don't know, Comrade Charles here would agree, like people are very thin and like the food shortage is mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes we wouldn't as a we had an impact by being such large amount of people coming in. Right. So mm-hmm. I don't know if they could capacity wise host us this time. And I heard it's because of not only because of the blockade, but then the pandemic that's happened. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think Cuba we were talking amongst ourselves, looks kind of the worst it's been because of the shortages and the fuel shortage. Mm-hmm. But even still, people help you. Like not once did I want to say this, not once did I go hungry. Mm-hmm. You know, they always fed me. And I went to so many different events, right? I was hosted mm-hmm. by the Institute for Friendship, Cuba's institutes, and we went to the Fidel Castro Center. We went to a major venue conference where the president was at, and we were fed all the time. But was there delays? Did things take longer? Yes, but I would say people always help you. The other thing I would say is the conversations I had with people were very important, because I think that like in the West, we like in Canada, okay, I'll say Canada, I'll stop saying the West, but like in Canada, people talk a lot about things they don't know. So like, it's like you've never left the province, right? And I get it, like everybody has struggles, right? But like, let's say you don't have we lack an education, like let's be honest, right? And so not only are we not reading, our government doesn't encourage education, you know, governments in Canada and the US are like, you said they weren't burning books, David, but like,
I mean, they're banning books, right?
You know, burning books, whatever, but like we don't have this information, and there people are so educated. Mm-hmm. Like people knew where I'm from, like they mm-hmm. understand where Pakistan's on the map, you know. Mm-hmm. They don't put it in the Middle East, you know. They know about Muslims, and they also talk to me about their unions. I would ask tons of questions, and like sometimes they would say, you know, a taxi driver once said, you know, I don't love what my union's up to lately, but you know, he also simultaneously told me that like he has family in like Florida or Miami, and that they hate it there and they regret ever coming to the United States. Mm-hmm. you know, and that he was sitting next to the driver who drove me to the airport, who happened to be a Black Cuban, and he was a, I think, white Cuban. And he said, and I don't want to like generalize, but he said to me, we're all the same. And we're all Cuban. And like, you know, he also said, America should be ashamed of what it did to indigenous people. Like people there, every time I've been twice, like blow my mind in terms of the amount of education they have. I don't know what you were going to say, Charles, but I'm hoping you agree with me.
I haven't met any of the Cubans who, and I have hosted some Cubans professors in Detroit before mm-hmm. I went and my bed and breakfast in Detroit. And they did complain about the food shortage, and they said they were not getting enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an opportunity while I was in Havana this time. When I didn't go out with the tour, I stayed in the hotel and ate lunch with the hotel workers. And so I got to see what they were eating.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it was really the equivalent of what I have seen people eating in the other parts of the Caribbean. I mean, beans and rice, mm-hmm. chicken, pork. It's probably not as much as they want it, but they have, but everybody gets their share.
Mm-hmm.
And the children get first, you know, they are privileged to get more and everything that they need first.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you don't see overweight people as much in the global South as you do in the United States and in the West, in the rich countries. It's rare to see people who are really obese, like we have become accustomed to. And that's not because we are healthy. It's because we're eating bad, toxic food. So it's really our weight is often a reflection of the poor.
The poverty in an ironic way, yeah.
Yes. So I don't know how to judge that.
Mm-hmm.
But I never heard anybody say that they were against the American people.
Mm-hmm.
They complain about the U.S. policies toward them, the blockade, the sanctions, all types of restrictions that are increasing. Trump added 242 additional sanctions against the Cubans to try to prevent any loopholes, any type of financial transactions that they can make in the world market. They try to close every possible door so that they can completely strangle the population.
Mm-hmm.
But it has not been successful. And so I say it's a miracle that they are still in existence and continue to spread their ideas about what humanity can be.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that it is strong in spite of all that we do and all that we have done and all of our negative intentions. And I would say generally, many countries, and I worked as an international correspondent in the 70s, 60s and 70s. And so I travel a lot in Africa and the Middle East. And so I've seen the type of poverty and the type that exists where you have in most countries, there are always large numbers of people that will follow you around and begging for money, begging mm-hmm. for anything, because we have disrupted the colonial policies have disrupted their economies. But I didn't see that in Cuba. I didn't see any homeless people.
Mm.
I can't say they don't exist, but I didn't see any, and I've seen them everywhere else I've been.
Yeah.
And you can't disguise, you can't disguise all the poverty when you have it. You know, even in the United States, we can't disguise the poverty here in Detroit and California.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something going on that is overwhelmingly positive. And we are afraid, the monster is afraid of the of David. Mm-hmm. The Goliath is afraid of David in this situation. But I don't think that I think that they definitely appreciate the solidarity that we have shown, and the people from all the other countries. I saw people from many countries in South America. Mm-hmm. And they really look up to and respect what the Cubans are doing.
I mean, as they should. And like I just want to bring up that distinction, because I think there's been a kind of negative, pessimistic trend in the U.S. left of when it comes to solidarity, where like they want to sort of speak for the global South, and they do. And the way they do that is not by necessarily trying to spread solidarity and build movements here that can fight against the imperialism that the U.S. does. They do it by doing this kind of weird antisocial excuse for hating their neighbors, right? And they blame like the American people, their co-workers and things like that, for American imperialism. I think it's a really negative thing. And I just wanted to bring that up because you see this a lot. And I don't know if it's maybe just an online kind of cultural thing that people do, but I think it's not very reflective of like what our comrades in Cuba think, or our comrades in Bolivia think, when it comes to like the US. But I wanted to talk a little bit, if y'all don't mind, before, because there's so much to get into. I want to talk a little bit in a second about like the union structure and things like that. But, you know, like Cuba has gone through pretty significant changes politically in the past few years. There's a new constitution, obviously a new president in the country. I mean, did you get any sense or have any conversations with people about some of these shifts and changes politically in the country with folks when you were there?
I don't know about the structure as much. Probably Amina knows more about that. But I did see, we attended a forum, which was led by either a member of the parliament or a professor who was an expert on the parliament and the new constitution. Mm-hmm. And he talked about a lot of the mechanism that went into creating this new constitution. It took several years, and it was a super democratic process. Mm-hmm. I mean, they began at the neighborhood level. Everybody in the country had to, they debated and discussed all the issues in the constitution from the ground up. It wasn't simply some political leaders making these decisions. Everybody, I think, the people who voted for us was about 90%.
Yeah, it was massive, if I remember correctly. Yeah,
very high. And but everybody had an opportunity to have an input in what, and they also created the a family law dealing with the gender issues that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And they decided that a marriage should be between two people. Mm. They don't say that it has to be a male and a female, you know, or what the gender has to be. So that liberated and addressed the issue of the gender discrimination. But it was impressive to me to see that everybody in the country was participating in developing a constitution. Mm-hmm. And then also, you don't have money in politics. Mm-hmm. Members of parliament don't get paid, period. They have a job, whatever job they have. And then they have to get elected by the people, first of all, in their neighborhood, have to nominate them. They know their character. They have to nominate them, but they don't. They just do their work, whatever their job is. And when it's time to have parliamentary voting and stuff, then they go and vote. And then they go back home and go back to work. Mm-hmm. So there's no stealing money.
Or running off to Cancun when the power goes out, like my illustrious senator did, right?
Right. And, you know, interestingly, that used to be the way it was in the United States. Congress was not a full-time, 20-year-around operation in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't know exactly when that changed, but members of Congress used to have jobs wherever they came from and go back home and work. Mm-hmm. And so definitely has not improved with our new methods.
But yeah, I mean, people might say, for example, that, you know, question how much democracy there is in Cuba. I'm curious if you have any responses to that, having been there a couple times now.
Well, see, I like this question, David, because I was born here. Okay, I want to start with that. And I just want to say, like, Americans and Canadians have this attitude, like they come all the way there, you know, and they're like, show me democracy, right? Show me where you guys are democratic. Like, and it's like, well, okay, I want to challenge you to think, like, why is your government, along with industries, like, look at the Amazon labor union folks, they came all the way there. And like Chris Small said, like, not only do you have industry, the NLRB, like legal systems fighting workers, you know, in America, obviously the same situation is where Americans just can't understand that, like, what am I trying to say? Americans can't understand a society that's not run by capitalism, mm-hmm. and where corporations and industry run everything from education to technology to biotech to everything is run by these monopolies, where in Cuba, it's just radically different and they can't understand that. Like, it still blows my mind that, like, when I come to Cuba, I see beaches. Beaches aren't owned by anybody. Mm-hmm. Right? Everybody has access to it. When I come to the United States, I can't even go to some docks, right? Like, you, even in Canada, you can't, you go up north and you go to places, it's like, oh, that's private property. Everything's private property, right? So, mm-hmm. like, we really need to stop sometimes looking as educated people and wanting to get education, stop always looking at things through that framework, because then you can go to a space and open your mind and listen to workers. And that's why I say worker to worker solidarity and people to people, like these people to people delegations are so important, because listening to the artists in Cuba who are in a union, I'm like, okay, well, that doesn't even exist in Canada. Okay, and only rich people are able to go enjoy the arts, right? Mm-hmm, galleries mm-hmm. are owned by rich people. Like, that's radically different. And then the fact that all workers have access to some form of pregnancy leave, and the family code just brought in parental leave. You don't even have that in the United States. No. So we need to look at these actual policies and, like, get away from this obsession of these concepts of like democracy in this high place, because you should then start from your own country and be like, well, do we even have democracy because, you know, of everything that has happened over the course of the pandemic? You know, in Canada alone, like, people didn't even have access to a vaccine for a very long time. You know, everything is people can't even afford homes, right? So we really need to look at Cuba in a new way and open ourselves to learning about something in a genuine way. And then we have to look at trade unionists who, like Chris and like others who are coming. And it's like, also when we talk to you about these things and we're doing these debriefs, like, what is our, like, people also, I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know. Like, they want to be like, what do you know? Like, what, like, I don't know where I'm going with this, but, like, what do you know? And it's like, what is my genuine, like, interest to, like, support Cuban people other than saying that I believe in internationalism and I believe in solidarity and I believe that it's actually a success story and that others should take time and go. And if you are in a union, whether you are in steelworkers, whether you are in La Yuna, whether you are in construction workers, look into departments that do political education. Some unions have a history of solidarity work. Like, try to get access to a little bit of professional development money or a little bit of support to go and do these visits, because they're very, very important.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we might open it up for in the last couple of minutes to see if anyone in the chat has any final questions. But, you know, could you talk about, like, the specific work that was being done by these brigades? I mean, I know you all were seeing the country, but, like, you know, what was going on there on the day to day?
One of the things our brigade did, Lisa, I went with a group of young people, people in their, most of them in their 20s, even teenagers. One of the leaders of our brigade was an 18-year-old woman, a brilliant, excellent leader. And I was just really amazed by the quality of the young people who were in that trip. We have a problem with our unions historically in the United States because of the fact that they can't work together throughout the industry. Mm. So we don't even have solidarity within the United States between unions. I mean, the steel workers don't work, they don't help the Teamsters, don't help the UAW. You know, so we've had attempts to change that, but the government has stopped it. Mm-hmm. So it would be difficult. And in addition to that, our unions, unfortunately, and I've been a union person all my mm-hmm. life. I grew up in a union house. And so I have a serious commitment to trade unionism. But we don't reach out to support the community where the union resides. Mm-hmm. And so that's different in Cuba. Totally opposite. So we need to be building solidarity in the United States first and then reach out to other countries. I mean, the imperialists don't recognize any boundaries or borders. We shouldn't be recognizing any kind of borders. We should build solidarity throughout our unions in spite of the law. We have to fight to change that mm-hmm. law, those laws, and support one another and support the communities where we are based. We need to adopt that community and lift up the people, address all the essential issues in the community, the housing, the health care, the education. Not only the unions, but I'm also active as a Christian revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the churches need to be involved in lifting up the communities wherever they reside, not simply taking in money, but being involved in service to the people everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's my religious commitment. And so people practice religion in Cuba. I was told, you know, before I went, that, you know, well, communists don't believe in religion. And Marx said, religion is the opium of the people and all that. Well, that's a lie. One of the first young people I met when I first went, she told me she was a Catholic and also a member of the Communist Party. I said, well, how could that be? Because I was brainwashed to accept the lies that I was taught in the United States. And our media, when it comes to international affairs, our major media basically is a mouthpiece for the State Department. Whether that's the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, any of the big networks, they represent, they ask first, they get permission from the State Department. Can I say this? What should I say? And that's what we get. Mm-hmm. So we think we're getting some diversity with it by reading or listening to multiple stations, the mainstream media, but we're getting the same crap from all of them. Mm-hmm. So we need to be following stations or programs like this, the alternative media all over the country, that the independent media that are trying to be honest and tell the truth. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem that we have. We are conditioned to think that we are not supposed to be involved. The ordinary person thinks they're not supposed to be involved in any way dealing with international affairs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's supposed to be left for the experts and the rich people and the highfalutin government officials. But if you could understand how gangs work anywhere, the Crips and the Bloods, the Mafia, you know how one gang controls this side of town, another gang controls others. That's what international affairs is.
Yeah.
So the biggest gang with the biggest guns, they make the rules. And that's what that's our policy now. So we have to change that.
No, and I think that's important. Cuba really shows a different model. There's like bad discourse in the US right now about like popular education and public education within the working class movement that, you know, workers are uninterested or even worse, sometimes incapable of understanding these things, right, which is so backwards thinking.
And you can't understand it because of the lies they're telling. They're very confusing, and they're using language that nobody understands. Yep. If they told the truth, people would understand.
And the first thing that they do in Cuba is like raise the literacy rate too. You know what I mean? Like, right. and not just right. so people can read Marx and Lenin, but so people can read Shakespeare and literature and all these things, right? To enjoy right. the full fruits of humanity.
I turned on the television in the hotel, and I saw about 10 different countries' programs. Mm-hmm. I saw no commercials. That was the best relief I've had.
People
tell me what to buy.
No commercials for
90% of the program is commercials.
No lawyer commercials or heart medicine stuff. And unless you had something to add to that, I know there's a couple questions in the chat.
I'll wait for the questions. I like your audience.
Audience is great. So y'all get these questions in. I'm going to translate this because it's a little long to read the whole thing. But the gist, and thank you so much, SRD Law PLLC, for asking this. But they wanted to ask, if y'all got any experience with this, and maybe you did in your conversations, but like, in the U.S. right now, like there's a lot of big, fights in politics, particularly around, I don't know, wedge issues or cultural issues. And they were just wondering, in your experience, what is the discourse like, basically? Like, what are things that maybe people are talking about and considering, maybe compared to an American or Canadian group? And that might be a difficult one to answer. So if you don't have anything, no worries either.
That's a difficult one.
Yeah.
I have to think about
that. Yeah. It's a good question, but I don't know if we're
focused. It is a good question. It's very important. I think people because I was in the group and I went around with that group, which was organized. Mm-hmm. So we had focus on the healthcare, focus on the labor, focus on education, focus on housing. And 85% of the population lives in a family home. Mm. You can't evict anybody from a house. Mm-hmm. The whole that each generation is responsible to the other generation and that home. The conversations that I heard among the people I met was about the issues that we were addressing in these structured forums. Mm-hmm. So the only time I had to talk to people outside of that was in the hotel. Mm-hmm. And they also were focused on essential issues. Mm-hmm. But they had a wide knowledge of what was happening in the country and what was happening in the world, which is completely different from conversations that I have with ordinary folks in the United States. Mm-hmm. Our discussions, first of all, is about the danger of living in the city. Yeah. I mean, how many people got killed that day? Mm-hmm. How many people got evicted? How many people got raped and robbed? And you turn on the news and the mainstream media, I mean, you get a heart attack just listening to 5 minutes of news. Yeah. I didn't talk to a lot of people outside, unfortunately, mm-hmm. on this trip. But the people who I saw in the gatherings were generally focused on the serious business. Mm-hmm. Now, they also have a lot of community type of entertainment. There are community centers where they have, they train young people in the arts, music, just about everything in the neighborhood. So this is something that now we have a problem right here in Detroit. There's nothing for young people to mm-hmm. do. When I was growing up, we had community centers. We had roller skating. We had dancing for kids. We had all the sports. And the schools had all these things and space for it. Swimming in this public schools. They have cut all of that out. Mm-hmm. So the young people are hanging out in the streets and getting into trouble because they don't have anything else to do and they don't have any jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see that in Cuba. Everybody had something to mm-hmm. do that was constructive and building relationships with one another face to face. And you see families walking around in the street together in what appears to be a very harmonious relationship, people holding hands, old couples walking around holding hands. Mm-hmm. You see that sometimes in the United States, but it's not the norm. So I wish I could answer that question better.
No, I mean, I think that's a really great answer. I think what they're getting at, because I think, one of the things that's really dark and difficult in the U.S. right now when it comes to organizing both like around socialist politics and the union organizing is like the destruction of the social spaces, right? And like, Margaret Thatcher's famous quote, like there is no society, there's just like individuals in the family. Unfortunately, in a lot of ways in this country, at least, like we are living in that world, right? We're like community and social spaces and things that aren't just like commodities or, not going to a bar, basically. Those have really declined in you know, in my life. And it makes it difficult because, like, I'll read with, you know, a lot of jealousy sometimes about some of, like, the early socialists and union organizing in this country. And, like, if they want to go to a small town in Oklahoma and want to start organizing workers in that community, they knew where they were because people were in bowling leagues or, you know, all these different social groups. And that has declined dramatically in this country. So it's a really important thing, you know, not a small thing, actually, like the commitment in Cuba to, like, building community spaces for people, I think.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I think we're getting close to wrapping up. I mean, there's just so much on the table. I want to throw to you all if, like, there's anything, any lessons or any ideas or things that you want to make sure that the audience gets, both about Cuba in general or your experience there. Because, you know, unfortunately, an hour, I don't think we'll be able to to paint the full picture, but we can get close.
I think that we in the United States who are involved in social change projects, we have to learn to build solidarity within the United States among ourselves. The environmentalists don't talk to the people who are trade unionists. The trade unionists don't want to talk to the folks in housing issues. And the healthcare workers are not working with the the people dealing with climate change. I mean, we have got to work together because the folks who are opposed to all of us are united against all of us. Mm-hmm. And we don't have the luxury of being individualistic in the situation. Mm-hmm. And as the U.S., is the de-dollarization taking place, the BRICS countries are rising. That means that the United States and the other Western capitalist countries are going to be struggling to survive in the way that they used to. And they're going to have to begin to exploit the local populations more than ever. So there are going to be major cutbacks in our social services, mm-hmm. and all the in our necessities, Social Security. I mean, it's on the chopping block. They don't want to admit it, but we're going to be facing third world conditions in the United States increasingly, and so we're going to have to work together for our own survival and quality of life here in ways that we haven't experienced probably since the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to also just echo what Professor Simmons is saying is that, you know, for our own survival and the survival of, like, our communities and what's left of our communities, and we need to be building solidarity between unions, between organizations that exist, between faith-based groups. You know,
right.
Charles said he's a Christian, I'm a Muslim, you know, and the only way we will learn is by having these conversations. And that's why I really believe in it as an organizer and as somebody who believes in internationalism, because these companies, these corporations, our bosses, these landlords are global, right? They're cross-border. And in order for us to overcome, we need to understand each other and build solidarity and really work together to get the justice and to make gains, and we will be successful. And Cuba's a model of success, as we've talked about today. And so I really, again, encourage people, if you can go, try to go, try to draft or ask for permission, or don't ask for permission, but go there and witness it, because it's been life-changing for me.
Well, so I think that we might be wrapping up, but in the last minute, if I'm sorry, folks, we're not gonna be able to get all the questions. A bunch of them came in really late, but one question somebody asked, and I wanted to sort of broaden it out, is for anybody who's listening today, who might be interested in doing more solidarity with Cuba, if y'all have any suggestions about maybe where they could go, particularly if they're a union member or something like that. And then also, you know, one of the people asked the question more broadly, if there's any organizations both in the U.S. and Canada that maybe people should be checking out their work to enact some change. But if there's anything y'all want to shout out, direct people to, we'd be happy to share it here.
Yeah, I think through the U.S., delegation was through the National Network on Cuba. They have an extensive list of all the different organizations, and really locally, there's so many organizations, for example, I've been going to Minneapolis. There's an organization that does incredible solidarity work for Cuba. And as well as community and faith-based groups. There are Pastors for Peace, there are faith-based groups that have been going from all different countries all around the world, and different types of physicians. There's different groups that really have been urging to end the blockade because they see it as, you know, a failure and not logical and inhumane. But for me, I've been working with the Canada-Cuba Friendship Association. So again, if your union doesn't do this work, that's okay too. There are amazing organizations in all over the country. In Canada, they're in the prairies, they're in the Maritimes, they're in Alberta. So just look out for them. And sometimes they are tied to faith-based groups.
Yes, and on June 25th, there's a national protest that's going on. They're going to D.C. and in most of the big cities, they're going to have protests about U.S. to get the U.S. To eliminate the blockade, hands off of Cuba. So that would be a good place to connect, whatever city you're in. I would just look up the National Network on Cuba and take a position. Those of you in the faith community and in the unions or environmentalists, take a position about how you can reach out and help lift up the human the quality of life throughout this planet. United States is not the world. You know, we are members of an international, the planetary community, and we have to protect the entire community. All life forms are at risk, and we have to stand up for our children and our grandchildren, and try to become informed. Don't just accept whatever you see in the media or whatever your politicians are saying. Try to do some research on your own, and look at independent alternative media.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, I think it's really important. I hope that everyone who's been listening to the show today and just in general knows that one of the most important things you can do is to get active and get organized and be, you know, a part of these communities and fight for a better world. Before we leave, it'd be malpractice on the show not to share my favorite photograph of Fidel. This is him when he was visiting Houston, where he was gifted a Stetson cowboy hat, which apparently he loved very much and wore for the entire trip. Both of y'all, thank you so much. It really was such a pleasure and an honor. I'm going to play some music and take us backstage. But for everyone else, we'll be back this Sunday with a bonus episode. We'll be back next Tuesday with a main show for Left Reckoning, where we'll be talking weed legalization laws across the country. Everyone take care and have a good weekend. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.